This conference is being recorded.
Okay, welcome everyone to our very special webinar today that we are featuring our Executive Director and our Federal Policy Director of Southern Alliance for Clean Energy live from Copenhagen at the International Climate Negotiations called COP15. And I'll let them explain what that means. Again, my name is Ula Reeves, and I'm the Regional Program Director. I'm going to just provide a brief background on our organization before we dive in. The Southern Alliance for Clean Energy is a regional nonprofit advocacy organization that has been around for more than 20 years. We work in 5 key states and have nearly 30 people on staff and offices around the region. We work at various levels of decision making, mostly federal and state, with some local efforts on a wide range of climate and clean energy policy issues. And we also work on our own projects, such as a demonstration project in which we are producing biodiesel from waste grease. You can learn more about all of the work that we're doing at cleanenergy.org, our website. And you can also follow us through our new dynamic blog at blog.cleanenergy.org. We are featuring special blog posts while our staff is in Copenhagen, so please do tune in there this week in particular, as we are posting more than one blog a day, live blogs and special feature blogs about everything that's happening and related to the Copenhagen International Climate Talks. So without further delay, I'd like to turn the presentation over to our Executive Director, Stephen Smith, who is, as I mentioned, live from Copenhagen. Take it away, Steve.
Hello. Can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Is the sound quality good? Great. Well, thank you, everybody, for joining. It's quite exciting to be here, and it's really great to have so many folks interested in hearing what's going on. As you know, the world is truly gathering here to discuss and hopefully plan for proactive actions that are going to protect our planet. Let me go ahead and advance to the next slide here. So let me just create the context. We're in Copenhagen. It's a beautiful old city here in Denmark. When you come into Copenhagen, as you can see from some of the blogs, you see the offshore wind turbines, the onshore wind turbines juxtapositioned with all the large coal-fired power plants and other things where this country is truly in transition. When you get on the ground and try to come over to the main conference center, it is quite overwhelming. Literally today, there were such long lines of people trying to get into the conference center that many people never got in and were stuck outside. And there's just such an overwhelming response to this conference, so many people wanting to participate and get into the door. There's been some major demonstrations to try to show broad support, not only here in Copenhagen, but around the world. And it's truly a historic moment when the people of the world are coming together to really try to craft a response to the dangers of global warming and really try to move the world beyond the addiction to fossil fuel and bringing a clean energy revolution. So it's very exciting. As you know, there's 92 nations that are gathered here. The heads of state will be arriving in the coming days, including the President of the United States, which is the first time for the actual conference of the parties, which is what we're here, that we've actually had a president attend, and Obama will be taking over the head of the U.S. delegation on Friday. There's a lot of anticipation and excitement about that. There are literally hundreds of non-government organizations from around the world, extremely international crowd, and so you literally walk around in the conference center and there's just so many different languages being discussed. So it's truly a global gathering, which is quite exciting. The goal here, obviously, is to craft a fair, ambitious, and binding international agreement to solve climate change and the dangers of global warming. Next slide. So this is all patterned off of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. This was the originally the treaty that was crafted at the Earth Summit back in 1992. Then President Bush won for the United States, actually participated, and the U.S. actually signed on to this. And it was basically saying that we want to move voluntary reduction measures to bring our emissions back to 1990 levels by 2000. There was a growing discussion about what is a dangerous impact to the environment, and there began a very deep conversation about what were the levels that needed to be reduced in order to protect the planet from dangerous anthropogenic impacts. And this was carefully discussed and has been hotly debated ever since 1992. But the science has sort of converging on a point, and this all started in 92. Next slide. Again, part of the United Nations. As the process advanced, there has been a sort of constant assessment and reevaluation of the goals. It was clear by the mid-1990s that the voluntary agreements were not going to work, and this led to the first binding set of agreements that were negotiated in Kyoto in 1997, which many of you have heard about, the Kyoto Protocol, and a number of countries, most of the developed countries, actually stepped up and made some commitments. The United States did not. We did participate in the discussions, but President Clinton never sent that forward. The rest of the developed world moved forward with that, and as you know, the Kyoto Protocol was really set into motion, but it will expire in 2012, and a new agreement is needed. That's why the urgency for these discussions and why Copenhagen is such an important conversation. The serious discussion for sort of the post Copenhagen phase began in 2007 in Bali. There was a lot of discussion, and the United States finally started sending some signals that they would constructively engage in that. And the goal was to actually get those binding agreements negotiated by this session, which is now happening in Copenhagen. And unfortunately, it is not likely that we're going to see the binding aspect of that agreement, although there is progress being made. Next slide. So the real question here is, are we going to get a treaty, an interim agreement, a mandate, or is this just going to be a muddled process that becomes more confused? Obviously, the goal now is to push a complete agreement here in Copenhagen or as soon thereafter as possible. There are discussions mid-year in 2010 in Bonn, Germany, and then the next conference of the parties, which is what is happening here in Copenhagen, will actually happen in Mexico City, probably in November of 2010. There's a great deal of discussion, but the core elements of the agreement must have solid emission reductions and targets with actions. There's a great discussion about financial investment in the clean energy economy and also the ability to have financing available for developing countries to be able to get to a clean energy economy and be able to actually literally improve their standard of living, but step over the addiction and dependency that we've seen in the developed world to fossil fuels and other dangerous technologies. There's a lot of discussion about technology transfer and how to reduce fossil fuel use. And then many nations in the world are already in a very real sense experiencing the ravages of global warming pollution and are desperate for adaptation measures and really being able to move forward in a way to have funds to assist in adaptation, because particularly the island nations are having a great deal of impact. The core elements that we've really been focusing on in our work here is the emission reductions and targets and actions and the financing, because there's a lot of people that say that even if we don't get the binding agreements here in December, if we can actually get the financial commitments from the developed world that really begin the money to flow in a significant and sustained way, ramping up over time, this particular negotiation may actually be successful as we continue to move forward to try to get the lockdown and binding nature of the targets. And obviously, one of the biggest issues is that You have the President of the United States coming over here, seemingly willing to make commitments, but anything that he agrees to here has to come back and be ratified by the full Senate of the United States. And unfortunately, the Senate has yet to even pass a climate bill. We have passed a climate bill in the House. It's not a perfect bill, but there's a lot of elements in it that are valuable and important. And we are still having a major discussion in the U.S. Senate, and it's bogged down. And so the president is in a precarious situation because he'll be coming over here with very high expectations from the international community, but yet at the same time, back at home, the U.S. Senate has not taken the action, and any treaty agreements that he was to negotiate here would ultimately have to come back to that very same Senate and actually get a 67-vote majority, a supermajority, in order to pass. And so that makes the threshold here for locking the United States into a binding agreement, given the inaction at the Senate, a very difficult situation that we're in right now. Next slide. So there has been progress. You may have heard through the reports in the media that when the president was over in Asia, there was some attempt to lower the expectations of the Copenhagen negotiations. And indeed, there were statements that were made by leaders, world leaders around that. But the president was able to have some very serious conversations with China while he was in Asia and get some outlines of some agreements there. And the United States made some statements about the 17% reduction in emissions from 2005 levels. Now, if you actually go back and translate that back to 1990 levels, it only amounts to about 4% below 1990 levels because, as you know, from the Rio time period until the present, we actually saw a fairly significant growth in U.S. emissions. And so a 17% reduction at 2005 levels is only a 4% reduction in 1990 levels. And that's a very important point to understand because the world community is obviously a lot of the countries are asking for a lot more of a commitment from the U.S. European Union nations have for a long time made a commitment to 20% below 1990 levels, and if they see engagement by other world powerhouses like the United States and some other countries, they would actually be willing to go even further than that. So the EU is at least in concept and statement willing to move forward much more aggressively. And then you have the island nations, which make up a collaborative group that are calling for, and this is what the AOSIS is, and they are calling for a 30 to 40% reduction below 1990 levels because many of those island nations, and this is the Alliance of Small Island States is what AOSIA stands for, and this group is very desperate for action now. They've been very outspoken and speaking very strongly here at the conference because many of them are literally inches away from losing their history, their culture of these islands as the ravages of sea level rise continue and the storm surges and everything really devastate their country. So you see this spectrum here of calls, and you can see the gap between what the United States has on the table now and what the world community is. Go ahead to the next slide. Now, one of the key points that were negotiated in Kyoto and has been a principle is that the developed countries, what we call the Annex I countries in the discussions, and that includes Europe and the United States and a number of other developed countries, the world community sees that because we over our history have developed to a very high standard of living on the back of fossil fuels. We have used fossil fuels to advance our standard of living, whereas there are many countries that are trying to catch up to us in their standard of living, and they feel like that because the United States and Europe has already occupied a very big space in the overall emissions that are in the atmosphere now, it is unfair for countries who are developing and trying to get their people up to a standard of living for them to have to make draconian cuts in emissions before they've even developed, because they feel like the developed world has a larger responsibility to reduce emissions more aggressively, because we've in essence occupied a long, if you think of the atmosphere as a pie, and there's only so much space in the atmosphere that can occupy these emissions before we see the devastating changes happening, the developed world has largely used up the vast majority of that pie, maybe as much as 3/4 or so of what is available. And yet we can't, the argument is that we can't ask China and India and the developed world to make the same type of reduction. So China and India have been very resistant to putting significant and binding reductions on the table at these international discussions, because they want the ability to continue to grow and develop their economies and their standard of living. Now, obviously, whether you agree with that or not, from what the world sees, from what the science shows, from what the Earth sees, and you're just looking at the total tons in the atmosphere, the fairness issue really doesn't matter. I mean, it's the amount of tons that are going in the atmosphere, and if we don't do something to bend the trend to make the curve go down from the emissions, whether they're from developed world or not, and again, the atmosphere does not distinguish between a pound of CO2 from China and a pound of CO2 from France or the United States. But in the international negotiations, this is a very, very strong and key sticking point. Whereas there's a lot of elements in the United States that say, no, we're not going to, the United States is not going to go beyond with China and India for competitive reasons. And so you can see, and many of you have heard this debate going on. The good news is that for the first time, China this year actually has started to put some commitments on the table. They are couching them in carbon intensity, they are struggling with how much of a binding commitment they want to make. But the reality is that they have put on a carbon intensity goal of reducing 45% below 2005. Now, that's if you translate that, that is still growth in the overall emissions for China, which is very important. They are making some very serious commitments, and China is moving very rapidly forward on energy efficiency investments, and they're making a goal of reducing by 20% their overall energy use. They're also making commitments to a minimum of 15% electric generation from renewable energies by 2020. And these are things that the United States still hasn't done yet. And so there is progress going on, but China is resisting binding commitments. India is a little more difficult. They're being even more resilient to making commitments, and they are moving forward. Both China and India are making massive investments in renewable energy and other low-carbon technologies. But again, they are being very, very resistant in making binding commitments thus far. And so we are likely not going to see, and I don't know that it's fair to expect, that you're going to see significant binding agreements from China and India in the course of these negotiations. But the fact that they're willing to put things on the table, the fact that they're willing to enter into bilateral discussions between countries, and the fact that they're actually recognizing that they have some responsibility is an important transition that has happened in this particular international discussion that we haven't seen before. Next slide. So when you get down to absolute requirements, this is an interesting slide that our research director have put up, and it shows where we ultimately need to go, which is the green goals that are actually scientifically driven, and then it shows you where business as usual is, where if we don't really do anything, the types of temperature increases that we would expect to see by the turn of the century, which are totally unacceptable. 8.5 degrees Fahrenheit or 4.8 degrees Celsius is going to be devastating for coral reefs, for all types of ecosystems, for continued disruption, for loss of glaciers and sea ice. It's just going to be absolutely unacceptable. The goal that we're looking for is something 2 degrees Celsius or below, and that's what the green line represents what we need to see in the golds. And you can see where the blue line is, which is sort of where we are right now with the proposals that are sort of on the table, that are the leading proposals, and you can see that gap, the gap that is needs to be closed. And so we have a long way to go. It is unclear at this point exactly where these negotiations are going to end up. There's a lot of debate going on. A number of the nations today walked out of the meeting in protest because they're not seeing the kind of commitments that they want to see, and so there's that kind of posturing, jockeying going on. Over the course, as I said, of the next few days, we're going to begin to see much more of the world leaders coming in, the heads of state and people on the caliber of the President of the United States coming in and really beginning to, I think, get down to a much more serious conversation. And this is where we hope to see some binding, or at least as close to binding as we can get, discussions going on. Next slide. Another, besides the golds, another big commitment that is on the table that is desperately needed is that the developing world feels very, very strongly that the developed world needs to put some significant resources on the table to help move the world past the need to be able to have to rely on fossil fuels to grow their economies. And so there's a discussion about a $10 billion commitment that is needed. EU, the European nations, have basically stepped up and said that they're willing to put a significant amount of money on the table, I think maybe as much as over half of that. The United States has not made a solid commitment to what kind of financing they're going to do. They have said in principle that they'll do, quote-unquote, their fair share, but it is still being hotly debated what that is and what is needed as sort of a quick start to be able to show a good faith effort in these negotiations would require, again, on the order of $10 billion a year, ramping up over time. And some of the outward projections are by 2010 and beyond, you know, we need to be looking at levels approaching $100 billion a year to really catapult the world in this. Now, not all of this has to come from public funds. There is a discussion about, you know, how the private sector engages in this. So this is really, given the amount of money that's being spent on energy, generally this is really a very small in the grand scheme of things. But it is very important to developed nations that these are not funds that are already coming to them for other kind of development activities, that they are additive instead of a replacement for those types of funds. So that's a very hotly debated conversation. And what we may see, and I would, if I was to preview what may happen on Friday, it would be that there is a likelihood that the United States may make more of a financial commitment, but still not be really able or willing to go much beyond the binding goals of reduction. So it's going to be very interesting to see how President Obama navigates those waters and tries to leave Copenhagen with the conference being a success and his presence here having pushed the agenda. But then at the same time, we're not sure that, given what's happening in the Senate, how far he's going to be able to go. So again, the goal here is for all the countries except for the what they call the least developed countries, the LDCs, to contribute. And that's a very significant part of the debate right now. Next slide. So in wrapping up, before we open up for questions, these are literally some shots from today. This is myself and Jen Renix. We went on a quick tour right off the coast of Copenhagen, and it's very inspiring because you can see the offshore wind turbines here. As many of you who have been following our work, and you'll be seeing tomorrow in some blog posts and everything, and you can go back through our blog and just look, we feel very bullish that particularly from northern Florida up to the Carolinas on the Atlantic continental shelf, that there's a tremendous opportunity for offshore wind development in the southeast, and that's going to really be a significant supplier of renewable energy. To meet with and talk with the Danish officials and really actually see firsthand the offshore wind deployment here is quite exciting. You can see in one of the slides this really interesting juxtaposition between the wind turbines in the foreground, which represent the transition that we're seeing happening in this country, and the high reliance they've had on fossil fuels. I mean, the country is like the Southeast, is over 60% dependent on fossil fuels, although they have made some very significant commitments, as you can see in the most recent blogs that we put up on the website, where they have outlawed any additional coal plants being built in the country, and that they are actually looking to go from about 15% renewables for Dong Energy, which is the largest energy provider here in Denmark, to go from about 15% renewables and 85% fossil, to flip that to where they're going to be 85% renewable and 15% fossil. So this is a very dramatic commitment by this country, and we're beginning to see that transition. So it's inspirational, and it is important, and it shows that the United States, in our part of the next country, down in the Southeast, where we're heavily dependent on fossil fuels, these are the types of commitments that are going to solve the climate crisis, and these are the type of investments that we're wanting to see. And the Danes are very aggressive in wind, and particularly offshore wind development, and I think there's a lot of lessons learned that we can pick up from that. So let me move on to the next slide, and we'll be wrapping up here for So there's a number of different ways that you can follow what we're doing. If you go to our website and hit our blog, you will see daily posts that we're putting up. We're trying to get the information up as quick as we can. Also, if you happen to enjoy using Twitter, we're actually now encouraging people to join us through Twitter, and they can get regular updates as we put things up and as news goes along. So these are ways that you can stay in touch with us in real time, and we're very eager to share what we know over the coming days. We did learn today that they are going to dramatically reduce the access to the conference in the coming days, and that they're going to significantly limit the number of non-governmental organizations that are actually going to have access to the conference, particularly on Thursday and Friday, and so they're going to start to sort of phase that down. The other thing that we're watching very closely is that there is a congressional delegation from the United States that's going to be coming over. There are going to be some that are in favor of the climate treaty, and there's others that are going to be talking it down. And so we're going to be trying to do some rapid response and counter some of the negative stuff that's going on. We know particularly Congresswoman from Tennessee, Marsha Blackburn, who seems to now be positioning herself as sort of the next Sarah Palin from Tennessee, is being very aggressive now and talking down the thing. She gave the Republican Weekly radio address and video last weekend, putting out all the negative talking points about why we can't do a climate bill in the United States and why the international agreement is bogus and this kind of other stuff. So, you know, as all of you know, we have a number of conservative members that are unfortunately wanting to oppose this. So let me step back now and open it up for questions. Ula, I'll turn it back over to you, and you can talk people through how to do this.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you so much, Steve. That was an excellent presentation, very insightful. I know folks may want to hear a little bit about the experiences that you all are having as well on the ground, but let me turn it over to Tony to handle, I know that there are some questions that have come in, and she can also inform folks how to unmute themselves if you've got a verbal question.
Hi, thank you. Yes, if you'd like to chat your question, you may do so by just typing your question in your control panel and hitting send. If you'd rather ask your questions verbally, there's a little yellow hand in the upper left-hand corner you can press. I do have a number of questions that have been chatted in, but I think I wonder if maybe Steve and Jen could just talk a little bit about what you're experiencing there on the ground. You know, who are you seeing, and what are other activities are going on around the negotiations?
Okay, let me give. Can you all hear me? Okay.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to hand it over to Jen here for a second because we're sharing one microphone. So here we go.
Hi, everyone. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, great. Yeah, as Steve said, this really has been an extraordinary but overwhelming experience. Just the literally thousands of people. When we arrived this morning, there was a queue of people to get in that I saw some pictures. We actually entered through a different line happily and were able to get in within maybe 15 minutes. There were people in lines for 2 to 3 hours is what we were hearing. And so if that's any idea of just how important this conference is and how many people are tracking and watching and observing and then also reporting back home, we were lucky enough to get in today with no problems. But as Steve said, they're going to be continuing to shut down the access a little bit. So we're taking advantage as best we can while we're here. The days that we are able, good access and getting in, we've been attending some side events. I was able to go briefly into an event today that was being put on by the US EPA was doing a webinar, live teleconference, sort of like what we're doing, in conjunction with the Department of Interior. One of the undersecretaries was there and was talking all about coastal climate impacts. And so I was attending on behalf of a few of my colleagues here who I knew would be interested in the information, talking a lot about sea level rise and impacts from storm surges and things like that. And that was just one of, I don't know, I don't have the program in front of me. I think there's something like 50 to 75 side events today. So a lot going on literally every day, all the time. Just as a side note, we are so far north right now that we have only about 6 hours of daylight. So we actually have not really seen the sun that much since we've been here. We generally arrive when it's fairly dark and we leave when it's dark. So we are hopeful to get to go on another tour. As Steve mentioned, we did the wind tour today, which was fantastic. So we're hoping we might get to do another tour, particularly if access gets a little more closed off here. So that's a little bit about sort of a day in the life while we're here on the ground. You want to queue up any of the official questions there, Tony?
Yes, thanks, Jen. The first question is, when is President Obama expected to join the meeting?
He is due to arrive, we believe, on Thursday night. That's what we're hearing, and that is part, Steve mentioned it before, but I just wanted to emphasize, this is the first time ever, this is the 15th conference of the parties, and this is the first time ever that all heads of state were invited and almost all of them accepted and are coming. That's an extremely significant, huge, important side note to this whole thing. And so we believe that our president, President Obama, will be arriving on Thursday night, and he is expected to, as Steve said, take over the delegation negotiations for the U.S. delegation on Friday, and that will be the final day with speeches and wrap-ups.
Okay, great. Thank you. The next question is, when Steve was talking about how a few of the developing countries walked out of the conference, what was the significance, or what is the significance of them walking out?
Yeah, we understand there's some different points of view on that, but we understand that some people say that this is just a right before the serious negotiations begin towards the end of this week, this is a way for some of the developing countries to really send a very strong message and sort of make their case. The question is, will they return tonight and then tomorrow? Now, if they stay out, if they continue to boycott and stay out over the next 24 hours or more, that could be a very significant side derailing of the conference. But most people that we've talked to thus far feel like that it is more of an effort to really send a very strong signal and let the developed world know that we need to hang together and that the developed world can't just dictate all the terms and if they really want to have a true international agreement. So we're, you know, everybody's monitoring that very carefully. These things have happened before, and they tend to close ranks before the conference is over, but you never know.
Great, thank you. The next question is, are any of the financial commitments devoted to multinational research and development of open source renewable energy technology? Are any of the financial commitments devoted to multinational research and development?
Well, I think they are, although, you know, I think a lot of those discussions are still being negotiated, and we don't have all of the details. And so, again, it's extremely fluid here. You get drafts, and then there's immediately multiple drafts, and others. So it's very hard to really keep up with the latest information because there's so much going on, and then there's, you know, proposals and counterproposals. But I do believe that that is the direction that people are going. There's a great deal of discussion of technology transfer and making sure that countries who have technology are really deploying that not only in their countries but around the world, particularly on the renewable energy.
Great, thank you. There may be some folks that have joined the audio portion of this webinar but may not be online. So if you have a question you'd like to ask, you may press *6 to unmute yourself and ask your question. In the meantime, while people are getting that all together, I'd like to ask Jen and Steve, what's on your agenda for the rest of the week? Are you attending any other side events or doing any sorts of tours that we might be interested in hearing about?
Yeah, we're going tonight to meet with a number of NGOs at a conference center offsite to begin to discuss, you know, a possible communication strategies based on the likely outcomes of this, so that there's some consistency in the messaging. Because we are part of what's called the U.S. Climate Action Network delegation. I serve on the board of directors for the U.S. Climate Action Network, but U.S. Climate Action Network is only one of multiple countries that have climate action networks. And so the Climate Action Network International, there have been conferences where the U.S. spin on it is very different, say, than the African or the European spin. And so there's really an attempt here to try to understand how people are going to frame up the outcomes in a united voice. You may have seen, if you go to the – I did a tweet while I was stuck in the airport in Chicago, and you can actually go to our website and see it. Every day there's a fossil award that is giving to the top three sort of outrageous things that are happening. And this – today, actually, the United States got their first fossil because, again, of this only willing to commit to 4%. So there's things like that going on. Tomorrow morning I will be meeting with former Vice President Al Gore and some others. That he's hosting a small group of environmental leaders to just discuss where we are in the negotiations. And then, again, the access begins to get more and more limited. Jen and I are actually debating. We went on this tour with quick tour out to look at the offshore wind turbines. There is another tour on Wednesday that this group is putting together that goes further north into Denmark and looks at not only wind, but looks at some other renewable technologies and energy efficiency things that the country's doing. And so we're debating that if the access is severely limited on Wednesday, we may actually participate in that tour and then again begin to try to share some of the information and then try to keep up with the developments online. We imagine that Thursday and Friday we're going to become sort of external viewers of the conference, because I think, again, it's going to be severely limited. And so our goal would then be to try to work with other environmental and non-government organizations here to interact where we can with the delegations and make sure that we communicate our perspective on the events towards the end. But again, I think because of the number of world leaders at the highest level, like President Obama, that are going to be here Thursday and Friday, I think they're going to really get very prickly about security, and I think it's going to end up bouncing a lot of us out.
Great. Thanks, Steve. That sounds very exciting for sure. The next question comes from Veronica. She says, it has struck me that there are a number of American businesses that are in developing countries. Are there any conversations about why the U.S. investing in the $10 billion needed will also benefit American corporations internationally? For example, she thinks that Coke, that it has a large presence in Africa, will also suffer from water shortages.
Well, no, that's a very good point, and there is a very a strong presence here of a number of U.S. And multinational corporations. There's a strong delegation that we understand is actually going to of large companies that are going to push for the 40% reduction. I think that business leaders are realizing that if you have the devastation in a lot of the developed world, and also the developing and developed world, there you're going to lose access to having a stable economy where people can buy their products. Obviously, there's a tremendous excitement about the opportunity associated with green jobs and green technologies. I'm going to hand the mic over here to Jen. She actually was able to, I got in late yesterday, she was actually able to participate in a bright green forum that they had here yesterday, and she can tell you a little bit about some of the companies and businesses and some of the things she saw there.
Thank you, Steve. Yeah, yesterday, over the weekend, a group called Denmark, now I'm blanking on the name. It's the International Denmark Development Corporation. Put on a two-day forum called Bright Green, with the idea of promoting what the bright green economy would look like. And there were hundreds of booths in this forum, in this conference center. Every single booth highlighted a business, a private business that is part of the bright green energy future. There were municipalities there showing just how far they're going in such a short time. There were even a few American-based companies that were there. There were a few other countries that were there highlighting their work, a few other Scandinavian. The vast majority were Danish companies from around Denmark. And I did a blog post today in conjunction with our research director, John Wilson, just about the impacts of all that's going on here. For instance, there is a city here in Denmark. I will butcher the name if I try to say it in Danish. It's Frederikshavn. They are aiming for 100% renewable energy by the year 2015. Not 10%, not 15%, some of the low numbers that make some of the United States elected leaders start squirming, but they are going for 100% literally in just 5 years, and they're already well on their way to that goal. So it was very inspiring to see all that was there, all of these businesses that have stepped up and are very excited. One of the main ones was Vestas, which as some of you on this call may know, Vestas is one of the world's leading wind turbine manufacturers. They have certainly put up many of the turbines that are here in Denmark and in other parts of the country. They actually do have a production facility in Colorado, and we were meeting with some of the folks there last night at a reception here to say, you know, some of the other sidebar things we're doing. We went to a wind energy meeting and reception, and they are interested and like the idea that, you know, we and others are very interested in having more of that business come to the Southeast. So we need to obviously work very hard here in the near term to get the policies better so that it is more receptive to having those businesses come, because right now they're having a less receptive environment without renewable energy standards. And certainly in the Southeast, we have a pretty gaping hole, with the exception of North Carolina, which has a modest 12.5% goal. The other states have no renewable energy goals. Any other questions on that?
Great. Thanks, Jen. The next question comes from Andy. Is the U.S. generally regarded as a climate change denying nation? And if so, does that hurt our standing in these negotiations?
Well, I think that people who are in the know here understand that the United States still is not really in a leadership position. They also struggle with, and there's a great deal of confusion. I was talking to somebody today about what's being discussed in Germany about how now that EPA has this authority, given the Supreme Court decision that they can regulate CO2 under the Clean Air Act, many countries believe, okay, well, even if the Congress doesn't act, EPA can go forward, and that's going to be how the United States delivers. Well, the problem is those of us who understand this understand that the Congress could quickly strip EPA of that authority by basically passing a law that supersedes what's going on. So there is a great deal of confusion. People are extremely hopeful for what President Obama represents. And I think that that is one of the things that many are looking forward to, is his presence. There's still a tremendous reservoir of optimism and excitement about President Obama. But I'm not sure that everyone here fully appreciates the difficult nature of our political system. They don't necessarily, I think, fully appreciate the enormous amount of money that is invested in the status quo and how that money is influencing our political decision-making. And so it is still greatly unclear that Obama is going to have the support he needs, given that we have multiple branches of government. So even though the judicial branch has just given the administrative branch the ability to regulate, the legislative branch could strip the administration of doing that. You know, there's these really thorny issues in the United States that is unclear that we're going to have the kind of support we need. So I don't know if that answered the question, but I would say, again, most people don't have here. I think a lot of the international folks don't have a great appreciation of that. I think some of the political leaders have some appreciation of President Obama's predicament. But again, I think that people are extremely frustrated that the United States still doesn't provide the kind of leadership that is needed given the absolute magnitude of this problem.
Great. Thank you, Steve. Any last questions? You could either chat them in or you may press star 6 to unmute yourself. Okay, this next question comes from Will. The question is, how do the delegates, including and especially the U.S. delegates, square their emission reduction proposals with the science, which inform us that many of the major emitters' proposals, especially U.S., China, India, are dangerously deficient?
Well, that's a good question. You know, the Todd Stern and Jonathan Pershing are the chief negotiators that are leading the delegation right now. I think that they are struggling with sort of a sense that they may personally understand that, but they are hampered by the political realities that we're dealing with the U.S. Senate and the House of Representatives, because even the Waxman-Markey bill that passed the House is still pretty modest in this arraign. You know, there was discussions in the committee that we should be at 20%. Reductions below 2005, but again, that is unfortunately significantly below. So I personally don't understand, you know, they're inside their heads totally. I think that they have the constraints, and it's come up here with NGO discussions with them, although we missed some of those earlier ones that happened last week, but just what has been telegraphed to me is that they are very sensitive to being pushed very aggressively here internationally and then coming home, and then there be this total disconnect with what the international community wants and what the political realities are within the United States. So that creates this imbalance or incontinuity between what they're able to do here, because you come here, you get this very strong sense of this yearning by the world for us to move beyond fossil fuels and all the developing world and even much of the developed world wanting to go much farther and faster. And then you have this this hindrance here in the United States. That's not just the United States. I mean, Canada has recently gone in the wrong direction. Australia tried to pass some stuff right before the discussions and ended up their political process rejected it. So, but I think the United States continues to be the biggest impediment. Obviously, you've got countries like Saudi Arabia and even Russia to some degree that are not playing constructive roles. But the reality is that I think the take-home message, if I was to convey anything to all of you on the phone, is that, and I'm sure many of you have, but we need to be in touch with our political leaders, particularly our senators, because that's where the debate is happening right now, you know, and let them know that this is a tremendous responsibility that they have to move forward. So I hope that answered the question, but we are hoping to get a briefing tomorrow from the lead delegation from the United States on where things stand. But again, it's been pretty clearly articulated to us that their marching orders are they can't get too far ahead of the political process in the United States. And that's unfortunate.
The last question here is coming from Chuck. Chuck's a veteran with Operation Free, and he wants to know what the next steps are. Is there a call to action, and what can people here on the ground in the U.S. do to help your efforts?
Well, I think anything you can do to really elevate the importance of these discussions, where elected officials in the White House are hearing that people in the United States are actually paying attention to this. What we don't want is we don't want the president coming over here and acting like he's, you know, that he doesn't have the support of his people in the United States. So I think sending letters and communicating with the White House over the next few days, I think you can send in emails to the White House at their website. Maybe we can actually put that up on our site where you can actually access that. But I think it's absolutely important to let the president know that that not only is the world watching him, but his constituents at home are watching. So that's, he needs to come over to Copenhagen with a very strong mandate from the American people. The other thing that I would argue is that, again, we absolutely have to keep all the pressure we can on our southern senators, because they, as a bloc, tend to be some of the biggest holdback in really moving a climate bill in the United States. And so we really need to keep pressure on there to basically send very clear signals to our congressional delegation. I think that there's been, you know, all this confusion that's come out about these hacked emails. You know, that is such a sideshow and such a an effort just to confuse the discussion. People need to speak very clearly and unequivocally with a very solid voice that this is a life-threatening, it's a planet-threatening issue, and that we all need to stand strong and speak with a very clear, strong voice for the rest of this week for sure, and then also be in constant communication and very vocal and outspoken about this, because this is truly the future of our planet. And when you come here and you see the huge gathering of such a multinational dimension of people, you really get a sense of that we have a global community, and that the United States, unfortunately, is leading to island nations going underwater, leading to a lot of the developed world being devastated. And so it's really very, very important that people weigh in and chime in on this. And we'll post some things up. I think that's a very good response. We'll post up, if we haven't already, we'll get some stuff up on the blog on how to communicate and maybe even put out a call to action in the last few days here of the conference, just to really send President Obama with, you know, he needs a tailwind. He needs a strong sense that the American people are with him to come over here and speak boldly and have vision in his statements and not just be constrained by, you know, those special interests that want to hold us back and keep us on a dangerous course.
Great. Thank you so much. Again, thank you to Steve and Jen for sharing this information with us. You may visit our blog. If you look at your screen right now, the URL for our blog is right there, blog.cleanenergy.org. This webinar has been recorded, so you will be able to find this presentation and the recording on our website under Multimedia and then Webinar Archive. If you look at your control panel, I had chatted y'all the link to that specific site. It should be posted within a day or so. Thanks so much for everybody who participated.
I think it can. Okay. Great. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.